Good morning. It's good to see you guys here today. My name's Chad, if we hadn't had the pleasure to meet, and it's great to see you guys here. If you're watching online with us, we're grateful you take time out of your weekend, and if you're in the room, we're super thankful to have you here as well. An announcement right off the top for you. Christmas Eve is quickly approaching, so I want to remind you we have three services for Christmas Eve, 2 o'clock, 3:30 and 5 o'clock. I want to remind you that 3:30 is typically the fullest service. So if you want to come to the 2 or the 5, that would be great. I recommend that to you if you want to avoid the crowd. But I look forward to seeing you on Christmas Eve. Another announcement this afternoon, just to make you aware, the college football world is about to find out what churches have known for a really long time, and that's never trust a committee, okay? So if you tune in for that. But we are in our series we're calling With Us about Christmas, and we're looking at the one verse in John 1:14 that talks about the Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us. Last week, Pastor Dean talked about the Word and how Jesus is the Logos, the reason for living, and he came into the world today. We're going to talk about that reality in this phrase, became flesh. So look forward to talking about that with you today. Our family lives a little bit north of Delaware, out in what some people might consider the country. And because of that, we have neighbors who are a little bit older, and we're the youngest family by far in kind of our area that we live. And so occasionally our neighbors do call us to come help them out with things from time to time. And not a negative thing at all. We enjoy doing that for them. In fact, it turns out that we get a lot of things in return. They end up giving us cucumbers and tomatoes and pumpkins and letting our kids swim in their swimming pool. So it's a really good arrangement. We love our neighbors. But one day, Mr. Greg and Miss Donna called us, and they said they needed our help because they couldn't find their remote control to their TV. And so they called us, and we said, yeah, sure, we'll come over. They thought it was under their bed, but they weren't exactly sure, and they can't get down on their hands and knees anymore because they're a little older. And so they asked us if we could come over. So I said, sure, so I'll be right over. So I took off across the yard to go over to their house. And my two boys said they wanted to go with me, so I was glad to have them go. So we all three went in to see Mr. Greg and Miss Donna. And when we got there, we caught up a little bit, visited with them, and then went back to the room, found the remote, thankfully, very quick process, and we were able to secure the remote for them. And I don't know if it was out of gratitude or what, but Mr. Greg said, hey, do your kids like stuffed animals? And in that moment, if I'd have been a more advanced parent, I would have said, oh, Mr. Greg, thank you so much for your generosity and for thinking about us. But our kids have so many stuffies. They could populate an entire stuffy zoo, and each of those stuffies could represent its own continent, even some countries. We have multiple stuffies to represent these countries. So no, we don't need any more stuffed animals, but thank you so much. But in that moment, those words were elusive. And I did not say, oh no, thank you, Mr. Greg. I said, yeah. They love stuffed animals. And in that moment, my fate was sealed. There was no turning back for what was coming next. And so Mr. Greg took off to the back of his house, and he said, okay, hold on one second. And right after he went back to his room, he came out with these. This is the scene that unfolded in his house, these stuffed animals. And to quote Clark Griswold, if I'd woken up with my head sewn to the carpet, I wouldn't have been more surprised than I was in that moment. I mean, I don't know what you think about when you think stuffed animal. I think stuffed animal. This is something entirely different than that. All right, thanks, Grace. Thank you. Appreciate you for bringing out the life-size jungle cats. We really appreciate that. You know, this is a picture of my kids, actually, with the stuffed animals. They came home that day. They still grace our house to this day, take up about a third of my oldest son's bedroom. So I sometimes wonder, is this how Joe Exotic got his start with jungle cats? Like, maybe this is the future that my children are headed on. I don't know. But I'll tell you, when Mr. Greg said, I'm going to go get them stuffed animals. I was picturing something completely different. And when he rounded that corner with those two monstrosities, I tell you, I was floored, right? Because I couldn't picture what was in his mind. What was in my mind and what was his mind were two different things. And I think when we think about the incarnation, and we think about who God is, and we think about God becoming flesh, I think Jesus had to become a human, and God wanted to become human in the person of Jesus so that he could show us what he really means, show us what he's really like. God's always been communicating with us, always been dwelling with us, but I think he wanted to specifically show us what God made human means, what God made tangible. You can see him, you can hear him, you can touch him. And that's the power of the incarnation. God becomes more real than he ever has. And we get a sense of what he really means when we see Jesus. And that's what we want to think about today. God become tangible. God become human. God become flesh. And so we're going to see that in John chapter 1 and verse 14. I want to remind you of the whole verse here. It says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory. Glory is the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." So we talked about Jesus as God, the Logos. And now we want to think about him as human, as flesh, that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. There's three things that this verse tells us that Christmas means. First of all, it tells us that Christmas means that God is vulnerable. Christmas means that God is vulnerable. And this is what we've been talking about in this whole series, that the big idea of this series, that God is writing himself into the human story. He has made himself vulnerable. This phrase became flesh. It's the Greek word sarx. And it can mean a lot of different things. It can mean literally skin, like the skin on your body. It can mean flesh as in lust of the flesh in reference to sin. But it can also mean humanity or human. And I think this is the sense of the word here in John 1:14, that the Word became human, became humanity. This is where we get our word incarnation. So Jesus is truly God and yet truly man. We just looked at Philippians in a series. We walked through the entire letter, New Testament letter of Philippians. And we talked about in Philippians 2 how Jesus emptied himself. And we talked about that being things that he gave up, like glory, his glory with the Father. But we talked about him emptying himself was even more so about what he took on and taking on this humanity. And he became vulnerable to become a human being. He became susceptible to all the things that we as human beings are susceptible to. He was born as a baby in a manger. What's more vulnerable than a baby? His birth narrative points to and highlights the vulnerability of Jesus, how he was forced to be laid in a manger and because there was no room in the inn. And he was a baby without the aid of modern medicine, a baby who was vulnerable to all the sickness of the time and disease of the time. And this is how he comes. Does he come on a horse? No. Does he come as a king? No. Does he come as a ruler or a conqueror? He doesn't come as any of those things. He comes as a baby, lowly and vulnerable. And we see that in this idea of became flesh. But in his vulnerability, he also became rejectable. When we think about him being vulnerable, we think about him being rejected. In fact, the birth narrative about there being no room in the end is a metaphor, not just for his humanity and his humility and his vulnerability, but it also was a foreshadowing that he would be rejected. That just as there was no room for him in the end, there was also no room for him with the religious leaders of his time. There was no room for him among the Jewish people. There was no room for him in humanity. He was other than. In fact, this is what John 1:11 says. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Even in his own family, he was rejected by many. So Jesus comes vulnerably to us, and he was rejected. But what might be the most stark contrast of this rejection is with the religious leaders themselves, because Jesus was born as a Jewish person. And he lived his life, and at his resurrection, he told his followers, "The whole Old Testament is about me. All the Old Testament scriptures, they point to me. They teach about me. They're about me. On the road to Emmaus, he explains all of that to the two disciples that he was walking with. And these Old Testament scriptures were the Old Testament scriptures that the religious leaders of his time knew better than anybody. In fact, we believe that the religious leaders of Jesus' day had the Old Testament memorized, the Old Testament law memorized. And what's so crazy is that the people who knew the scriptures the most couldn't recognize God of the scriptures when he was standing right in front of them. And they didn't just not recognize him, they rejected him. They despised him, and they executed him. But that's what Christmas means, that God opened himself up to be killable, and ultimately we killed him. It's fascinating, isn't it? And it's still just the beauty and wonder of the good news to me, is that how can Jesus offer his love so freely and yet still be rejected so widely? How could he offer his love so freely and yet still be rejected so widely? It's a mystery to me. But this is what he did. He became vulnerable. He became rejectable. And I think this morning God would want us to know that he's in Jesus, in Christmas, holding his hands out to us and wanting to know us. But this morning, you can reject him. But why would you want to? Why would you want to reject such love and such generosity and such vulnerability? When we talk about Christmas means that God is vulnerable, some of us may kind of push back on that. We go, oh, I don't know about vulnerability. I don't know about weakness. That seems like a really illogical thing to equate with God. Because we think about vulnerability as weakness. We're like, I don't know if I want to identify with someone who's vulnerable, who's got an element of weakness. I don't know if I want to do that. Especially men, we struggle with vulnerability. This became evident in me and my wife's first Christmas together. We'd been married just a few months, and I've not always been a handy person. I was the kind of guy that when there needed to be a repair around the house, I would make it worse trying to fix it myself, right? So that when I actually called the repair guy, he had more work to do and charged me more money. That was me. That's how handy it was. I've gotten a little bit better, I will say. I've gotten a little bit better. I've gotten better tools. But that's who my wife married. She married someone who's completely unhandy, and so we decided to put up some outside Christmas decorations. By the way, that's a great topic to cover in premarital counseling, okay? And if you can put up outside Christmas lights together, your marriage has a chance, okay? That's all I'm gonna say. And so my wife gives me the task of taking the lights and wrapping them around the two columns at the front of our house, wrapping them around two strands, top to bottom on our columns in front of our house. And so I go in to get the only tool that I have available to me for this task, a desk stapler. And I walk out with my tool in hand. Well, I had a desk stapler and a chair because we didn't own a ladder or a step stool. And so there I am, headed out of the door, about to stand on this chair and use this desk stapler to get these lights up. And my wife, my lovely wife, my beautiful wife, my new wife, my encouraging wife says to me, that's not going to work. And then it became a competition. I was like, oh, it'll work. So I put the chair down, I string the lights, and I get the desk stapler up, and I start banging it against the column. And of course it doesn't work. You all know that. It's not going to work. So I got off the chair, I walked back inside, I said, you know what, honey, you're right. It didn't work. You were so right. I don't know why I didn't listen to you and go to Home Depot and grab a better tool and a stapler, industrial size stapler. I should have done that. I'm gonna do that now. No, I didn't say that, right? I threw the stapler into the flower bed and went off to pout like a two-year-old. Why? Because being vulnerable is really hard to do, isn't it? It's hard to be vulnerable. It's hard to say I was wrong. It's hard to show weakness. And I'm a human being who is flawed. How do you have a God who is perfect, a Jesus who is sinless, becoming so vulnerable? It just makes it all the more unbelievable that he came in this way. Christmas means that God is vulnerable. He doesn't come on a horse, but he comes in a manger. He doesn't come with a crown, but he comes with cradle cap. He doesn't come with a royal robe, but he's wrapped in swaddling clothes. He isn't born in a palace, but he's born in a cave in the backside of Bethlehem in the country in Judah. And although he has a royal bloodline, he's not born to parents that are royalty, but he's born to a carpenter and a young girl. He doesn't come extending a sword, but extending belonging and compassion and forgiveness and healing. He comes not in power and authority, but in a humility and service. He opens himself up to be rejected. And it's absolutely remarkable. And it's wonderful news because it's this vulnerability that opens up the door for you and I to have a relationship with God. This is how he comes. Because of Jesus, Christmas means that God is vulnerable. But this verse tells us in John 1:14 that he became flesh. It tells us something else about Christmas. Not only does Christmas mean that God is vulnerable, but Christmas means that God is relatable. God is relatable. Look here at Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 14 through 16. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. And let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The writer of Hebrews here is talking about Jesus as our high priest. I think this idea of him becoming human, taking on flesh, he became a high priest for us. And he wasn't just a high priest, he was the high priest. Priests were go-betweens between God and the people. That they would help make atonement. They would help mend the relationship. When the human side of things went awry and there was sin against God, the priest would come between the two and help mediate peace through sacrificial offerings and through confession and forgiveness. That's what a priest did. So Jesus is described in Hebrews as the high priest. All the other high priests were just representatives. He was the high priest, the one that would go between us and God to bring us into relationship with him. And we have a high priest who understands everything that we go through. He's absolutely relatable because he's been there. He's walked a mile in our shoes. He knows what it's like to experience every part of humanity except sin. He didn't sin. He did it all without sin. But even then, 2 Corinthians tells us that he became sin for us. So he knows what it is to stand condemned for sin, even though he was without sin, didn't commit sin. He knows what it is to stand condemned for sin. So even in that way, he understands. He understands what we're going through, even though he never committed sin. Think about it another way. It's one thing for Elon Musk to sell electrical cars. It's another thing if he became an electric car. It'd be completely different if he became an electric car. Now that's committing to your task, isn't it? That's what God did. He went all in humanity when he came as a human. And he empathizes and sympathizes with everything that we go through. I mean, think about the difference between sympathy and empathy. That God just doesn't sympathize with us. He just doesn't sit up in heaven and look down on us and go, oh, that must be really hard. Oh, that must be really challenging. No, no. He comes into the human story in the person of Jesus, and now he empathizes with us so that he could literally sit across from us and say, I've been there. I've been there. I know what you're feeling. I have felt what you're feeling. I've walked a mile in your shoes. I know what it's like to experience that. I know what it's like to be in your position. That's who we have in the person of Jesus. He doesn't just sympathize with us, doesn't just feel sorry for us. No, he knows what it's like. Here in Hebrews 4, it says that he was tempted in every way like we are. We have a record of the temptation of Jesus. Surely he was tempted in other ways besides what we have in Matthew 4. But Matthew 4 gives us some insight into how Jesus was tempted. In Matthew 4, Jesus has been fasting for 40 days. And at that point, he's very hungry. Naturally, after 40 days, he would be hungry. And Satan comes to him and says, turn these rocks into bread and eat something. Now, Jesus in his fasting wasn't just going without food. He had a purpose for that. He was preparing himself to enter full-time ministry, to do this work that God had given him to do in public work. And he was going without food for a purpose. And yet Satan comes to him at the point of his needs, 40 days without food, and offers him bread and tempts him at the point of his need. And I love that because it paints a picture for us that he knows what it's like to be tempted around his needs. So the next time you're tempted around a need that you have, whether it's physical or relational or mental or financial or spiritual, whatever your need is, he knows what you're going through. He's been tempted at the point of his need. But not just at the point of his need, he was tempted at the point of desire. Satan takes Jesus to the top of a mountain and offers him all this prestige and honor and glory. All he has to do is bow his knee to Satan. And Jesus says, I'm not doing that. I'm not giving in to this lust for power, this desire that you're trying to tempt me with. Now, desire in and of itself is not bad. It's a really good thing. But Satan is always giving us, offering us shortcuts to God's best when it comes to our desires. And he offers him these shortcuts over and over, and Jesus rejects them. And so the next time you're tempted at a point of your desire, something that you want that's a good desire, and you're tempted in that way, know that he's been there. He knows what that feels like. And he's with us in that temptation. And then here's what I would encourage you about too. He's not just with us in the temptation. He's with us after we fail. And Hebrews 4:16 encourages us what to do in the time of temptation and even the time of failure. It says, draw near with confidence to the throne of grace. What do you do when you're tempted at a point of your need or a point of your desire? What do you do when you've failed and you've blown it? You go to your high priest who has walked in your shoes and knows in every respect what it is to be a human being. That's where you go. He's there for you, and he knows what you're going through. He knows what you felt, what you're dealing with. He empathizes. But he doesn't just empathize with us in our temptation. The text here says that he empathizes with us around our weakness. And I think this is particularly meaningful because Jesus knows what it's like to be tired, to be hungry, to be lonely. He knows what it is to feel loss and to grieve. He knows what it's like to lose someone that you love, to watch them lose their life. He knows what it's like to be betrayed. He knows what it's like to be unjustly accused. Even in all the weakness that we experience in our world, he knows what that's like. And he even wrestled with God in prayer. You remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he's wrestling with God in prayer, he says, Lord, if there's any other way for you to accomplish this mission, please let this cup pass from me. If there's any way for you to accomplish this salvation except through the cross and the suffering for sins that I'm about to do, if there's any way to accomplish that, God, could you do it? And what was God's response? No. There's no other way. There's no other way to accomplish this mission than through the cross. Even when we've wrestled with God in prayer, he knows what it feels like. When we feel like our prayers are not getting above the ceiling, he knows what that's like. But even now as I'm talking, I feel like some subjects require more than words. Some topics require a little bit of a song. You guys up for a song today? Okay. Thanks, Grace. There's a great cultural commentary on this very idea by one of the best theologians of our time. And he wrote these words. Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers. Remember when you're talking to the man upstairs. Just because he doesn't answer doesn't mean he don't care. Some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered. Some of God's greatest gifts are too often unanswered. Some of God's greatest gifts, unanswered prayers. Should I wear the hat the rest of the message? Or? No, okay. It's true, right? He knows what it's like to wrestle with God in prayer, right? And it's one of those that if you think about, aren't you glad that as hard as it was for Jesus, that God's answer to that question was, to that prayer was no? No, there's no other way. This is the way that they come to faith in me. This is the way that salvation is accomplished. It's through the suffering of Jesus, who is absolutely relatable. He knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what it's like to suffer. He knows what it's like in our weakness. He is relatable. Christmas means that God is relatable. And I love this because Jesus didn't just save us by his death. He saved us by his life. Jesus is true humanity. He is who God designed us to be in the Garden of Eden. That's who Jesus is. And so he doesn't just save us with his death. He saves us with his life. And in his obedience, we get his obedience applied to our life as if we'd always obeyed. We get his righteousness applied to our lives. That's what it means. That's what Christmas means. That's what it means that he is relatable. As one pastor says, in the garden, God asked Adam, trust me about the tree, and he didn't. But in the garden, God said to Jesus, trust me about the tree, and he did. Christmas means that God is vulnerable, means he's relatable. And lastly, this phrase became flesh means that God is knowable. God's knowable. Now, this can't be overstated. That God is knowable. If you look at the Old Testament, you'll get a little bit of a picture that God has always wanted to dwell among people. God has always walked with people. Even in the garden, God walked with Adam in an intimate relationship with him. But there's also limits to God's presence. In fact, you go back to the Old Testament tabernacle in the temple, and you'll see that God was always limiting his presence. In fact, only one man, one day a year, could come into the presence of God. And that day was the Day of Atonement. One day a year, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, into the presence of God, and make atonement for the people. But he was the only man one day a year allowed into the presence of God. Other priests were allowed into the holy place, but not into the Holy of Holies. And still others were allowed in courts outside of the holy place. There was a court of women. There was a court of Gentiles. And so there was a limit to the presence of God. God said, I want you to have access to me, but you can only come so far. You can have access to me, but you can only come so far. And we see how God dealt with individuals. We see something similar. When God called Moses, he called him over to a burning bush. And he said, take off your shoes, for you are on holy ground. Not all of us get a burning bush. Only Moses got a burning bush. When God spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting and he would go out to share what God had shared with him to the people, they had to veil his face because they couldn't look at his face because the glory of God was shining on his face. So Moses was walking around with a veil over his face so that people could look at him. This is how God related to his people. Even Isaiah, when Isaiah encounters God in the throne room, he says, I saw God high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. What does Isaiah do? He falls on his face before God. Now you see Ezekiel. Ezekiel does the same thing. He encounters God in a unique way, and he falls on his face. Look at what Ezekiel 1, 26 through 28 says. Listen to the use of language that Ezekiel is grasping for here. He says, above the expanse that was over their head was the likeness of a throne, and in appearance like sapphire. Seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with human appearance, and upward from that had the appearance of his waist. And I saw as it were gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw as it were the appearance of fire. And there was brightness all around him. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. So here Ezekiel falls on his face. Are you getting a picture here in all this descriptive language? Like, look at that last phrase. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. He didn't say, such was the appearance of the Lord. He says, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory. That's like three descriptive words removed from God. So Ezekiel doesn't, what do you see here? He doesn't have the language. He doesn't have the vocabulary to describe what he's seeing. We don't have the language for God. This is what you see all over the Old Testament. People falling on their face, veiling their face, not able to put together language for what they're seeing. And yet, here's the thing. Jesus is the language. Jesus is the Word. He is the Word of God. Come to us to help God, who's always wanted to know us and dwell among us, but he's come to make God knowable. He's the Word. He's the vocabulary. He's the language. Now we can know God because of him. Listen to what Hebrews 1:1-3 says. Long ago, and at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Jesus shows us what God is like. Christmas shows us what God is like. He removes the veil that would cover Moses' face. He ripped the veil that would separate us from the presence of God in the temple and tabernacle. He removed every barrier. The divide is gone. The limits are gone. Now we all have access to the presence of God because of the person of Jesus. Unprecedented access that we wouldn't have otherwise because God became flesh. And I think this is such great news because it means that God's not aloof and distant and sitting up in the heavens and looking down on us. No, he became us. He became one of us, so that we can know him. He wants to know us. And I think we want to know him too. I think we want to know and be known by God. I think we do. I think we see this in our human relationships. I don't know about you, but when I first meet someone, the first question I always want to ask them is, where are you from? And then after they tell me where they're from, I immediately want to tell them the one person that I know who lives where they're from. Do you do this? Why do we do this? Because as soon as you're like, hey, where are you from? Oh, Arkansas. I know some people in Arkansas. Do you know Jim? They're like, who? Right? It's, why do we do this? And yet, there's something about wanting to know each other and wanting to be known that just kind of comes out in these relationships we have with others. I think it's more so with God, that we were born with this innate desire in his image to know him and be known by him. And finally, in Christ, he becomes knowable. He's always been with us, always been revealing himself. I'm not taking away from that. But man, in Jesus, he becomes tangible in a way that he's never been before. So I hope this morning, wherever you are, that you'll see that God became human at Christmas in a vulnerable way, in a relatable way, in a knowable way, all so that we could have a relationship with him. And he's inviting you into that relationship today. And you can. You can walk out of here and absolutely reject him. But why would you want to? Every year around this time, we like to read a book called Song of the Stars with our kids. This is a book by Sally Lloyd-Jones. If you've never heard of it, recommend it to you. It's a great book to read. So I thought to close the message today, I would just read this book for you, and I hope you can follow along as we do. This is what it says. The world was about to change forever, and it almost went by unnoticed. But the leaves that night rustled with a rumor, and news rang out across the open fields. A song drifted over the hills. The wind whispered it softly in the sycamore trees that waved their moonlight branches to the sky. A barn owl took flight. Woodland creatures stirred. It's time. It's time. In the pine woods, two deer raised their heads. A big brown bear sniffed the air, and a red fox darted. The faces of little flowers lifted to the sky. It's time. It's time. The sky shouted it to the seas that thundered it to the waves that roared it to the great white whales that sang it to the starfish in the deep. And tiny sandpipers danced it on shining sands. It's time. It's time. The running rivers bounded over boulders, and the otters clapped and played and sang to the ducklings that splashed and quacked to the salmon that leaped and leaped. a tiny field mouse and insects and little creeping things and sparrows and robins and every single blade of grass squeaked and hummed and chirped. It sang, "It's time, it's time." Wild stallions drummed it to the ground. Get ready, be glad, be glad. On a lonely peak, a lion raised his strong head and roared it out to the empty wilderness, the mighty king, the prince of peace. Suddenly, angels lit up the whole sky and a great choir sang it loud. It's time, he's come, at last, he's here. In a little town, in a little shed, in a little window, a candle flickered in the dark. And a tiny cry rang out in the cold night air. And high above, a single star set in the highest heaven shone out brighter than all the others and poured down silver onto the little shed, a light to light up the whole world. The animals stood around his bed. The whole earth and all the stars and sky held its breath. The one who made us has come to live with us. And a young mother with no place to rest, nowhere to stay, kept it as a song inside her heart, our rescuer. And they gazed in wonder at God's great gift, lying on a bed of straw, wrapped in rags, a tiny little baby. Heaven's son, sleeping under the stars that he made. Let's pray together. God, it's an absolute wonder that the God who made the stars would stoop to sleep under them. And yet that is what you've done. You become vulnerable. You've walked a mile in our shoes. All so that we could know you and be known by you. And Lord, when we think about that, we're in awe of Christmas. We're in awe of Jesus. And I pray that this morning, in each of our hearts, that there might be a rebirth of sorts of Jesus in our hearts this Christmas. And Lord, as we think about you wanting to know us and us being born with this desire to know you, God, in this moment, I pray that we would respond in connection to the one who did so much to connect with us. We would respond in worship to the one who gave up worship to become a baby. That we would respond with adoration to the one who's truly deserves it. Light of the world, you step down into darkness so that we could know you. Thank you, Jesus. We pray it in your name.